And you'll see I'm right, Eddie. They're bad friends. Not our sort. Not for you. You think it over and ask yourself if your ma ever told you wrong before. You think about it and... I'm running, she thought with a sick and hurtful dismay. I'm running away from my own son. Oh, God, please don't let this be. Ma. For a moment she almost fled anyway, scared of him now. Oh, yes, he was more than Eddie. She sensed the others in him, his friends, and something else. Something that was beyond even them. And she was afraid it might flash out at her. It was as if he were in the grip of something, some dreadful fever, as he had been in the grip of the bronchitis that time when he was 5, when he had almost died. She paused, her hand on the doorknob, not wanting to hear what he might say, and when he said it, it was so unexpected that for a moment she didn't really understand it. When comprehension crashed down, it came like a loose load of cement, and for a moment she thought she would faint. Eddie said, Mr. Keene said my asthma medicine is just water.
What? What?
She turned, blazing eyes on him.
Just water, with some stuff added to make it taste like medicine. He said it was a placebo.
That's a lie. That is nothing but a solid lie. Why would Mr. Keene want to tell you a lie like that? Well, there are other drugstores in Derry, I guess.
I've had time to think about it, Eddie said softly and implacably, his eyes never leaving hers. And I think he's telling the truth.
Eddie, I tell you, he's not. The panic was back, fluttering.
What I think, Eddie said, is that it must be the truth, or there would be some kind of warning on the bottle. Like if you take too much, it will kill you, or at least make you sick. Even...
Eddie, I don't want to hear this, she cried, and clapped her hands to her ears. You're just not yourself, and that's all that it is.
Even if it's something you can just go in and buy without a prescription, they put special instructions on it, he went on, not raising his voice.
His gray eyes lay on hers, and she couldn't seem to drop her gaze or even move it.
Even if it's just Vic's cough syrup or your Geritol.
He paused for a moment. Her hands dropped from her ears. It seemed too much work to hold them up. They seemed very heavy.
And it's like... You must have known that too, Ma.
Eddie, she nearly wailed it.
Because, he went on, as if she had not spoken at all. He was frowning now, concentrating on the problem. Because your folks are supposed to know about medicines. Why, I use that aspirator 5, sometimes 6 times a day. And you wouldn't let me do that if you thought it could, like, hurt me. Because it's your job to protect me. I know it is, because that's what you always say.
So, did you know, Ma?
Did you know it was just water?
She said nothing. Her lips were trembling. It felt as if her whole face was trembling. She was no longer crying. She felt too scared to cry.
Because if you did, Eddie said, still frowning, if you did know, I'd want to know why. I can figure some things out, but not why my ma would want me to think water was medicine, or that I had asthma here, he pointed to his chest, when Mr. Keene says I only have it up here, and he pointed to his head.
She thought she would explain everything then. She would explain it quietly and logically. How she had thought he was going to die when he was 5, and how that would have driven her crazy after losing Frank only 2 years before. How she came to understand that you can only protect your child through watchfulness and love. That you must tend a child as you tended a garden, fertilizing, weeding, and yes, occasionally pruning and thinning, as much as that hurt. She would tell him that sometimes it was better for a child, particularly a delicate child like Eddie, to think he was sick than to really get sick. And she would finish by talking to him about the deadly foolishness of doctors and the wonderful power of love. She would tell him that she knew he had asthma, and it didn't matter what the doctors thought or what they gave him for it. She would tell him you could make medicine with more than a malicious meddling druggist's mortar and pestle.
Eddie, she would say, it's medicine because your mother's love makes it medicine. And in just that way, for as long as you want me and let me, I can do that. This is a power that God gives to loving, caring mothers. Please, Eddie, please, my heart's own love, you must believe me.
But in the end, she said nothing. Her fright was too great.
But maybe we don't even have to talk about it, Eddie went on. Mr. Keene might have been joking with me. Sometimes grown-ups, you know, they like to play jokes on kids. Because kids believe almost anything. It's mean to do that to kids, but sometimes grown-ups do it.
Yes,
Sonia Kasprak said eagerly. They like to joke, and sometimes they're stupid, mean, and... So I'll kind of keep an eye out for Bill and the rest of my friends, Eddie said, and keep right on using my asthma medicine. That's probably best, don't you think? She realized only now, when it was too late, how neatly, how cruelly, she had been trapped. What he was doing was almost blackmail, but what choice did she have? She wanted to ask him how he could be so calculating, so manipulative. She opened her mouth to ask, and then closed it again. It was too likely that, in his present mood, he might answer. But she knew one thing, yes, one thing for sure. She would never, never, never set foot into Mr. Nosey Parker Keene's drugstore again in her life. His voice, oddly shy now, interrupted her thoughts. Ma? She looked up and saw it was Eddie again, just Eddie, and she went to him gladly. Can I have a hug, Ma? She hugged him, but carefully, so as not to hurt his broken arm or dislodge any loose bone fragments so they could run an evil race around his bloodstream and then lodge in his heart. What mother would kill her son with love? And Eddie hugged her back. 7. As far as Eddie was concerned, his ma left just in time. During the horrible confrontation with her, he had felt his breath piling up and up and up in his lungs and throat, still and tideless, stale and brackish, threatening to poison him. He held on until the door had snicked shut behind her, and then he began to gasp and wheeze. The sour air working in his tight throat jabbed up and down like a warm poker. He grabbed for his aspirator, hurting his arm but not caring. He triggered a long blast down his throat. He breathed deep of the camphor taste, thinking, "It doesn't matter if it's a placebo. Words don't matter if a thing works." He lay back against his pillows, eyes closed, breathing freely for the first time since she had come in. He was scared, plenty scared. The things he had said to her, the way he had acted, it had been him, and yet it hadn't been him at all. There had been something working in him, working through him, some force, and his mother had felt it too. He had seen it in her eyes and in her trembling lips. He had no sense that this power was an evil one, but its enormous strength was frightening. It was like getting on an amusement park ride that was really dangerous and realizing you couldn't get off until it was over, come what might. No turning around, Eddie thought, feeling the hot, itchy weight of the cast that encased his broken arm. No one goes home until we get to the end. But God, I'm so scared, so scared. And he knew that the truest reason for demanding she not cut him off from his friends was something he could never have told her. I can't face this alone. He cried a little then, and then drifted off into a restless sleep. He dreamed of a darkness in which machinery, pumping machinery, ran on and on. 8. It was threatening showers again that evening when Bill and the rest of the losers returned to the hospital. Eddie was not surprised to see them come filing in. He had known they would be back. It had been hot all day. It was generally agreed later that that third week of July was the hottest of an exceptionally hot summer, and the thunderheads began to build up around 4 in the afternoon, purple, black, and colossal, pregnant with rain, loaded with lightnings. People went about their errands quickly and a little uneasily, with one eye always cocked at the sky. Most agreed it would rain good and hard by dinner time, washing some of the thick humidity out of the air. Derry's parks and playgrounds, underpopulated all summer, were totally deserted that evening by 6. The rain had still not fallen, and the swings hung moveless and shadeless in a light that was a queer flat yellow. Thunder rumbled thickly. That, a barking dog, and the low mutter of traffic on outer Main Street were the only sounds that drifted in through Eddie's window until the losers came. Bill was first, followed by Richie. Beverly and Stan followed them, then Mike. Ben came last. He looked excruciatingly uncomfortable in a white turtleneck sweater. They came to his bed, solemn. Not even Richie was smiling. Their faces, Eddie thought, fascinated. Jeezum crow, their faces. He was seeing in them what his mother had seen in him that afternoon, that odd combination of power and helplessness. The yellow storm light lay on their skins, making their faces seem ghost-like, distant, shadowy. We're passing over, Eddie thought, passing over into something new. We're on the border. But what's on the other side? Where are we going? Where? Hello, Eddie, Bill said. How you did a-doin'? Okay, Big Bill, Eddie said and tried to smile. Had a day yesterday, I guess, Mike said. Thunder rumbled behind his voice. Neither the overhead light nor the bedside lamp was on in Eddie's room, and all of them seemed to fade in and out of that bruised light. Eddie thought of that light all over Derry right now, lying long and still across McCarran Park, falling through the holes in the roof of the Kissing Bridge in smudged lackadaisical rays, making the Kenduskeag look like smoky glass as it cut its broad, shallow path through the barrens. He thought of Seesaw standing at dead angles behind Derry Elementary as the thunderheads piled up and up. He thought of this thundery yellow light and the stillness, as if the whole town had fallen asleep. Or died. Yes, he said, it was a big day. My folks are going out to a movie the night after the next, Bill said, when the pictures change. We're going to make them then. The silver balls, Richie said. I thought, it's better this way, Ben said quietly. I still think we could have made the bullets, but thinking isn't good enough. If we were grown-ups... Oh, yeah, the world would be peachy if we were grown-ups, Beverly said. Grown-ups can make anything they want, can't they? Grown-ups can do anything they want, and it always comes out right. She laughed a jagged, nervous sound. Bill wants me to shoot it. Can you feature that, Eddie? Just call me Beverly Oakley. I don't know what you're talking about, Eddie said, but he thought he did. He was getting some kind of picture anyway. Ben explained. They would melt down one of his silver dollars and make two silver balls a little smaller than ball bearings. And then, if there really was a werewolf residing at 29 Niebold Street, Beverly would put a silver ball into its head with Bill's bullseye slingshot. Goodbye, werewolf. And if they were right about one creature who wore many faces, goodbye, it. There must have been some sort of expression on Eddie's face, because Richie laughed and nodded. I know how you feel, man. I thought Bill must have lost his few remaining marbles when he started talking about using his slingshot instead of his dad's gun. But this afternoon, he stopped and cleared his throat. This afternoon after your ma blew us out of the water was how he had been about to start, and that obviously wouldn't do. This afternoon we went down to the dump. Bill brought his bullseye. Look. From his back pocket, Richie took a flattened can which had once held Del Monte pineapple chunks. There was a ragged hole about 2 inches in diameter through the middle of it. Beverly did that with a rock from 20 feet away. Looks like a .38 to me. De Trashmouth was convinced, and when De Trashmouth is convinced, De Trashmouth is convinced. Killing cans is one thing, Beverly said. If it was something else, something alive... Bill, you should be the one, really. No, Bill said. We all took turns. You saw how it went. How did it go? Eddie asked. Bill explained, slowly and haltingly, while Beverly looked out the window with her lips pressed so tightly together they were white. She was, for reasons she could not explain even to herself, more than afraid. She was deeply embarrassed by what had happened today. On the way over here tonight, she had argued again, passionately, that they try to make the bullets after all. Not because she was any more sure than Bill or Richie that they would actually work when the time came, but because if something did happen out at that house... The weapon would be in Bill's, someone else's hands. But facts were facts. They had each taken 10 rocks each and shot the bullseye at 10 cans set up 20 feet away. Richie had gotten 1 out of 10, and his one hit was really only a nick. Ben had gotten 2, Bill 4, Mike 5. Beverly, shooting almost casually and appearing to aim not at all, had banged 9 of the 10 cans dead center. The 10th fell over when the rock she fired bounced off the rim. But first, we gotta make the ammo. Night after next? I should be out by then, Eddie said. His mother would protest that, but he didn't think she would protest too much, not after this afternoon. Does your arm hurt? Beverly asked. She was wearing a pink dress, not the dress he had seen in his dream. Perhaps she had worn that this afternoon when Ma sent them away, on which she had appliqued small flowers and silk or nylon hose. She looked very adult, but also somehow very childlike, like a girl playing dress-up. Her expression was dreamy and distant. Eddie thought, I bet that's how she looks when she's sleeping. Not too much, he said. They talked for a while, their voices punctuated by thunder. Eddie did not ask them about what had happened when they came to the hospital earlier that day, and none of them mentioned it. Richie took out his yo-yo, made it sleep once or twice, then put it back. Conversation lagged, and in one of the pauses there was a brief click that made Eddie look around. Bill had something in his hand, and for a moment Eddie felt his heart speed up in alarm. For that brief moment he thought it was a knife. But then Stan turned on the rooms overhead, dispelling the gloom, and he saw it was only a ballpoint pen. In the light they all looked natural again, real, only his friends. "I thought we ought to sign your cast," Bill said. His eyes met Eddie squarely. "But that's not it," Eddie thought with sudden and alarming clarity. "It's a contract. It's a contract, Big Bill, isn't it? Or the closest we'll ever get to one." He was frightened, and then ashamed and angry at himself. If he had broken his arm before this summer, who would have signed the cast? Anyone besides his mother and perhaps Dr. Handor? His aunts in Haven? These were his friends. And his mother was wrong. They weren't bad friends. Maybe, he thought, there aren't any such things as good friends or bad friends. Maybe there are just friends. People who stand by you when you're hurt and who help you feel not so lonely. Maybe they're always worth being scared for and hoping for and living for. Maybe worth dying for, too, if that's what has to be. No good friends, no bad friends. Only people you want, need to be with. People who build their houses in your heart. Okay, Eddie said a little hoarsely. Okay. That'd be real good, Big Bill. So Bill leaned solemnly over his bed and wrote his name on the hillocky plaster of Paris that encased Eddie's mending arm, the letters large and looping. Richie signed with a flourish. Ben's handwriting was as narrow as he was wide, the letters slanting backward. They looked ready to fall over at the slightest push. Mike Hanlon's writing was large and awkward because he was left-handed and the angle was bad for him. He signed above Eddie's elbow and circled his name. When Beverly bent over him, he could smell some light flowery perfume on her. She signed in a round Palmer Method script. Stan came last, and he wrote his name in tight-packed little letters by Eddie's wrist. They all stepped back then, as if aware of what they had done. Outside, thunder muttered heavily again. Lightning washed the hospital's wooden exterior in brief, stuttering light. "That's it?" Eddie asked. Bill nodded. Come over to my house after supper, day after tomorrow, if you can, okay? Eddie nodded, and the subject was closed. There was another period of desultory, almost aimless conversation. Some of it was about the dominant topic in Derry that July, the trial of Richard Macklin for the bludgeon murder of his stepson, Dorsey, and the disappearance of Dorsey's older brother, Eddie Corcoran. Macklin would not break down and confess, weeping on the witness stand for another 2 days, but the losers were in agreement that Macklin probably had nothing to do with Eddie's disappearance. The boy had either run away or it had gotten him. They left around 7:15, and the rain still had not fallen. It continued to threaten until long after Eddie's ma had come, made her visit, and gone home again. She had been horrified at the signatures on Eddie's cast, and even more horrified at his determination to leave the hospital the following day. She had been envisioning a stay of a week or more in absolute quiet so that the ends of the break could set together, as she said. Eventually, the storm clouds broke apart and drifted away. Not so much as a drop of rain had fallen in Derry. The humidity remained, and people slept on porches and on lawns and in sleeping bags in back fields that night. The rain came the next day, not long after Beverly saw something terrible happen to Patrick Hochstetter. Chapter 17. Another one of the missing. The death of Patrick Hochstetter. 1. When he finishes, Eddie pours himself another drink with a hand not completely steady. He looks at Beverly and says, "You saw it, didn't you? You saw it take Patrick Hochstetter the day after you all signed my cast." The others lean forward. Beverly pushes her hair back in a reddish cloud. Beneath it, her face looks extraordinarily pale. She fumbles a fresh cigarette out of her pack, the last one, and flicks her Bic. She can't seem to guide the flame to the tip of her cigarette. After a moment, Bill holds her wrist lightly but firmly and puts the flame where it's supposed to go. Beverly looks at him gratefully and exhales a cloud of bluish-gray smoke. "Yeah," she says, "I saw that happen." She shivers. "He was crazy, Bill says, and thinks. Just the fact that Henry let a flaco like Patrick Hockstetter hang around as that summer wore on, that says something, doesn't it? Either that Henry was losing some of his charm, some of his attraction, or that Henry's own craziness had progressed far enough so that the Hockstetter kid seemed okay to him. Both came to the same thing. Henry's increasing, what, degeneration? Is that the word? Yes, in light of what happened to him, where he ended up, I think it is. There's something else to support the idea, too, Bill thinks. But as yet, he can only remember it vaguely. He and Richie and Beverly had been down at Tracker Brothers, early August by then, and the summer school that had kept Henry out of their hair for most of the summer was just about to end, and hadn't Victor Chris approached them? A very frightened Victor Chris? Yes, that had happened. Things had been rapidly approaching the end by then, and Bill thinks now that every kid in Derry had sensed it. The losers and Henry's group most of all. But that had been later. Oh, yeah, you got that right, Beverly says flatly. Patrick Hockstetter was crazy. None of the girls would sit in front of him in school. You'd be sitting there doing your arithmetic or writing a story or a composition, and all at once you'd feel this hand, almost as light as a feather, but warm and sweaty. Meaty. She swallows, and there is a small click in her throat. The others watch her solemnly from around the table. You'd feel it on your side, or maybe on your breast. Not that any of us had much in the way of breasts back then, but Patrick didn't seem to care about that. You'd feel that touch, and you'd jerk away from it and turn around, and there Patrick would be, grinning with those big rubbery lips. He had a pencil box full of flies, Richie says suddenly. Sure, he'd kill them with this green ruler he had, and then put them in his pencil box. I even remember what it looked like, red with a wavy white plastic cover that slid open and closed. Eddie is nodding. You'd jerk away and he'd grin and then maybe he'd open his pencil box so you could see the dead flies inside, Beverly says. And the worst thing, the horrible thing, was the way he'd smile and never say anything. Mrs. Douglas knew, Greta Bowie told on him, and I think Sally Mueller said something once too. But I think Mrs. Douglas was scared of him too. Ben has rocked back on the rear legs of his chair and his hands are laced behind his neck. She still cannot believe how lean he is. I'm pretty sure you're right, he says. Well, what happened to him, Beverly? Bill asks. She swallows again, trying to fight off the nightmarish power of what she saw that day in the Barrens, her roller skates tied together and hung over her shoulder, one knee a stinging net of pain from a fall she had taken on St. Crispin's Lane, and other of the short tree-lined streets that dead-ended where the land fell, and still falls, sharply into the Barrens. She remembers, oh, these memories, when they come, are so clear and so powerful, that she was wearing a pair of denim shorts. Really too short, they came only to just below the hem of her panties. She had become more conscious of her body over the last year, over the last 6 months, actually, as it began to curve and become more womanly. The mirror was one reason for this heightened consciousness, of course, but not the main one. The main one was that her father seemed even sharper just lately, more apt to use his slapping hand or even his fists. He seemed restless, almost caged, and she was more and more nervous when she was around him, more and more on her mark. It was as if there was a smell they made between them, a smell that wasn't there when she was in the apartment alone, one that had never been there when they were in it together, not until this summer. And when Mom was gone, it was worse. If there was a smell, some smell, then he knew it too, maybe, because Bev saw less and less of him as the hot weather wore on, partly because of his summer bowling league, partly because he was helping his friend Joe Tamerly fix cars. But she suspects it was partly that smell, the one they made between them, neither of them meaning to, but making it just the same, as helpless to stop it as either was helpless to stop sweating in July. The vision of the birds, hundreds and thousands of them, descending on the roof peaks of houses, on telephone wires, on TV aerials, intervenes again. And poison ivy, she says aloud. Well, what? Bill asks. Something about poison ivy, she says slowly, looking at him. But it wasn't. It just felt like poison ivy. Mike? Never mind, Mike says. It will come. Tell us what you do remember, Bev. I remember the blue shorts, she would tell them, and how faded they were getting, how tight around my hips and butt. I had half a pack of Lucky Strikes in one pocket and the bullseye in the other. Do you remember the bullseye? She asks Richie. But they all nod.
Bill gave it to me, she says. I didn't want it, but
She smiles at Bill, a little wanly. You couldn't say no to Big Bill, that was all. So I had it, and that's why I was out by myself that day, to practice. I still didn't think I'd have the guts to use it when the time came. Except, I used it that day. I had to. I killed one of them. One of the parts of it. It was terrible. Even now it's hard for me to think of. And one of the others got me. Look. She raises her arm and turns it over so they can all see a puckery scar on the roundest part of her upper forearm. It looks as if a hot circular object about the size of a Havana cigar had been pressed against her skin. It is slightly sunken, and looking at it gives Mike Hanlon a chill. This is one of the parts of the story which, like Eddie's unwilling heart-to-heart with Keene, he has suspected but never actually heard.
You were right about one thing, Richie, she says. That bullseye was a killer. I was scared of it, but I sort of loved it, too.
Richie laughs and claps her on the back. Shit, I knew that back then, you stupid skirt.
You did, really?
Yeah, really, he says. It was something in your eyes, Bevy.
I mean, it looked like a toy, but it was real. You could blow holes in things.
And you blew a hole in something with it that day, Ben muses. She nods. Was it Patrick, you?
No, God, no, Beverly says. It was the other. Wait.
She crushes out her cigarette, sips her drink, and gets herself under control again. Finally, she is. Well, no. But she has a feeling it's the closest she's going to get tonight.
I was roller skating, you see, and I fell down and gave myself a good scrape. Then I decided I'd go down to the Barrens and practice.
I went by the clubhouse first to see if you guys were there. You weren't. Just that smoky smell. You guys remember how long that place went on smelling of smoke? They all nod, smiling.
We never really did get the smell out, did we? Ben says.
So then I headed down to the dump, she says, because that's where we had the tryouts, I guess you'd call them, and I knew there'd be lots of things to shoot at. Maybe even, you know, rats. She pauses. There's a fine misty sweat on her forehead now.
That's what I really wanted to shoot at, she says finally. Something that was alive. Not a seagull. I knew I couldn't shoot a gull, but a rat. I wanted to see if I could.
I'm glad I came from the Kansas Street side instead of the old Cape side, though, because there wasn't much cover over there by the railroad embankment. They would have seen me, and God knows what would have happened then.
Who would have seen you?
Them, Beverly says. Henry Bowers, Victor Criss, Belch Huggins, and Patrick Hockstetter. They were down in the dump, and... Suddenly, amazing all of them, she begins to giggle like a child, her cheeks turning rose red. She giggles until tears stand in her eyes.
What the hell, Bev? Richie says. Let us in on the joke.
Oh, it was a joke, all right, she says. It was a joke, but I think they might have killed me if they knew I'd seen.
I remember now, Ben cries, and he begins to laugh, too.
I remember you telling us.
Giggling wildly, Beverly says,
they had their pants down and they were lighting farts.
There is an instant of thunderstruck silence, and then they all begin to laugh. The sound echoes through the library. Thinking of exactly how to tell them of Patrick Hockstetter's death, the thing she fixes on first is how approaching the town dump from the Kansas Street side was like entering some weird asteroid belt. There was a rutted dirt track. A town road, actually. It even had a name, Old Lime Street, that ran from Kansas Street to the dump, the only actual road into the Barrens. The city's dump trucks used it. Beverly walked near Old Lime Street, but didn't take it. She had grown more cautious. She supposed all of them had, since Eddie's arm had been broken, especially when she was alone. She wove her way through the heavy undergrowth, skirting a patch of poison ivy with its reddish, oily leaves, smelling the dump's smoky rot, hearing the seagulls. On her left, through occasional breaks in the foliage, she could see Old Lime Street. The others are looking at her, waiting. She checks her cigarette pack and finds it empty. Wordlessly, Richie tosses her one of his. She lights up, looks around at them, and says, heading toward the dump from the Kansas Street side was a little like... two. Entering some weird asteroid belt. The dumpoid belt. At first, there was nothing but the underbrush growing from the spongy ground underfoot,
and then you would see your first dumpoid. A rusty can that had once contained Prince spaghetti sauce, maybe, or a Soke soda bottle crawling with bugs attracted by the sweet, sticky remains of cream soda or birch beer. Then there would be a bright wink of sun kicking off a scrap of tinfoil caught in a tree. You might see a bed spring, or trip over it if you weren't watching where you were going, or a bone some dog had carried away, gnawed, dropped. The dump itself wasn't so bad, was in fact sort of interesting, Beverly thought. What was nasty, and sort of creepy, was the way it had of spreading, of creating this dumpoid belt. She was getting closer now. The trees were bigger, mostly firs, and the bushes were thinning out. The gulls cheeped and cried in their shrill, querulous voices, and the air was smudgy with the smell of burning. Now, on Beverly's right, leaning at an angle against the base of a spruce tree, was a rusty Amana refrigerator. Beverly glanced at it, thinking vaguely of the state policeman who had visited her class when she had been in the third grade. He had told them that such things as discarded refrigerators were dangerous. A kid could climb into one while playing hide-and-go-seek, for instance, and smother to death inside. Although why anyone would want to get in a scroungy old... She heard a shout, so close it made her jump, followed by laughter. Beverly grinned. So they were here. They had left the clubhouse because of the smoky smell and had come down here. They were maybe breaking bottles with rocks, maybe just dump-picking. She began to walk a little faster, the nasty scrape she had gotten earlier now forgotten in her eagerness to see them. To see him, with his red hair so much like hers. To see if he would smile at her in that oddly endearing, one-sided way of his. She knew she was too young to love a boy, too young to have anything but crushes. But she loved Bill just the same. And she walked a little faster, her skate swinging heavily from her shoulder, the sling of his bullseye beating soft time against her left buttock. She almost walked into them before realizing it wasn't her gang at all, but Bowers's. She walked out of the screening bushes, and the dump's steepest side lay about 70 yards ahead, a twinkling avalanche of junk lying along the high angle of the gravel pit. Mandy Fazio's bulldozer was off to the left. Much closer in front of her was a wilderness of junked cars. At the end of each month, these were crushed and hauled off to Portland for scrap, but now there were a dozen or more, some sitting on bare wheel rims, some on their sides, one or two lying on their roofs like dead dogs. They were arranged in two rows, and Beverly walked down the rough, trash-littered aisle between them like some punk bride of the future, wondering idly if she could break a windshield with the bullseye. One of the pockets of her blue shorts bulged with the small ball bearings that were her practice ammo. The voices and laughter were coming from beyond the junked-out cars and to the left, at the edge of the dump proper. Beverly rounded the last one, a Studebaker, with its entire front end missing. Her hail of greeting died on her lips. The hand she had put up to wave did not exactly fall back to her side. It seemed to wilt. Her first furiously embarrassed thought was, "Oh, dear God, why are they all naked?" This was followed by the scary realization of who they were. She froze there in front of the half-Studebaker with her shadow stapled to the heels of her low-topped sneakers. For that one moment, she was totally visible to them. If any of the four had looked up from the circle they were squatting in, he could not have missed her, a girl of slightly more than medium height, a pair of skates over one shoulder, the knee of one long coltish leg still oozing blood, her mouth slack-jawed, her cheeks scarlet. Before darting back behind the Studebaker, she saw that they weren't entirely naked after all. They had their shirts on, and their pants and underpants were simply pulled down to their shoe tops, as if they had to go number two. In her shock, Beverly's mind had automatically reverted to the euphemism she had been taught as a toddler. Except who ever heard of four boys going number two at the same time? Once out of sight again, her first thought was to get away fast. Her heart was pumping hard, her muscles heavy with adrenaline. She looked around, seeing what she hadn't bothered to notice walking up here when she thought the voices she heard belonged to her friends. The row of junked cars on her left was really pretty thin. They were by no means packed in door to door as they would be in the week or so before the crusher came to turn them into rough blocks of twinkling metal. She had been exposed to the boys several times walking up to where she was now. If she retreated, she would be exposed again, and this time she might be seen. Also, she felt a certain shameful curiosity. What in the world could they be doing? Carefully, she peeked around the Studebaker.
Henry and Victor Criss were more or less facing in her direction. Patrick Hockstetter was on Henry's left. Belch Huggins had his back to her. She observed the fact that Belch had an extremely large, extremely hairy ass, and half-hysterical giggles suddenly bubbled up her throat like the head on a glass of ginger ale. She had to clap both hands over her mouth and withdraw behind the Studebaker again, struggling to hold the giggles in.
"You've got to get out of here, Beverly. If they catch you..."
She looked back down between the junked cars, still holding her hands over her mouth. The aisle was maybe 10 feet wide, littered with cans, twinkling with little jigsaw pieces of safety glass, scruffy with weeds. If she so much as made a sound, they might hear her, particularly if their absorption in whatever strange thing they were doing flagged. When she thought of how casually she had walked up here, her blood ran cold. Also, what in the world can they be doing? She peeked again, seeing more of the details this time. There was a careless scatter of books and papers nearby. School books. They had just come from their summer classes then, what most of the kids called dummy school or makeup school. And because Henry and Victor were facing her way, she could see their things. They were the first things she had ever seen in her life, other than pictures in a smudgy little book that Brenda Arrowsmith had showed her the year before, and in those pictures you really couldn't see very much. Bev observed now that their things were little tubes that hung down between their legs. Henry's was small and hairless, but Victor's was quite big, and there was a cloudy fuzz of fine black hair just over it.
"Bill has one of those," she thought,
and suddenly her whole body seemed to flush at once. Heat rushed through her in a wave that made her feel giddy and faint and almost sick to her stomach. In that moment, she felt much the way Ben Hanscom had felt on the last day of school, looking down at her ankle bracelet and observing the way it flashed in the sun. But he had not felt the intermixed sense of terror she felt now. She looked behind her once more. Now the pathway between the cars leading to the shelter of the Barrens seemed much longer. She was scared to move. If they knew she had seen their things, they would probably hurt her. And not just a little. They would hurt her badly. Belch Huggins bellowed suddenly, making her jump, and Henry yelled,
3 feet. No shit, Belch. It was 3 feet. Wasn't it, Vic?
Vic agreed it was, and they all roared with troll-like laughter. Beverly tried another look around the junked Studebaker. Patrick Hockstetter had turned and half-risen so that his butt was nearly in Henry's face. In Henry's hand was a silvery, glinting object. After a moment's study, she made it out as a lighter.
"I thought you said you felt one coming on," Henry said.
"I do," Patrick said.
"I'll tell you when. Get ready. Get ready. It's coming. Get... now!"
Henry flicked the lighter. At the same moment, there was the unmistakable ripping sound of a really good fart. There was no mistaking that sound. Beverly had heard it enough in her own house, usually on Saturday night after the beans and Frank's. A regular bear for his beans was her father. As Patrick blew off and Henry flicked the lighter, she saw something that made her jaw drop. A bright blue jet of flame appeared to roar directly out of Patrick's bum. To Bev, it looked like the pilot light on a gas burner. The boys roared their troll-like laughter, and Beverly withdrew behind the sheltering car, stifling mad giggles again. She was laughing, but not because she was amused. In some very weird way, it was funny, yes, but mostly she was laughing because she felt a deep revulsion accompanied by a sort of horror. She was laughing because she knew of no other way to cope with what she had seen. It had something to do with seeing the boys' things, but that was by no means all or even the great part of what she felt. She had known, after all, that boys had things, the same way she knew that girls had different things. This was only what you might call a confirmed sighting. But the rest of what they were doing seemed so strange, so ludicrous, and yet at the same time so deadly primitive that she found herself, in spite of the giggling fit, groping for the core of herself with some desperation.
"Stop," she thought, as if this were the answer. "Stop, they'll hear you. So just you stop it, Bevy."
But that was impossible. The best she could do was to laugh without engaging her vocal cords so that the sounds came out of her in a series of almost inaudible chuffs, her hands pasted over her mouth, her cheeks as red as Mac apples, her eyes swimming with tears.
"Holy shit, that hurts," Victor roared.
12 feet. Henry bellowed. "I swear to God, Vic, 12 fucking feet. I swear to my mother's name.
I don't care if it was 20 fucking feet. You burned my ass off."
Victor howled, and there was more bellowing laughter. Still trying to giggle silently from behind the sheltering car, Beverly thought of a movie she had seen on TV. John Hall had been in it. It was about this jungle tribe. They had a secret rite, and if you saw it, you got sacrificed to their god, which was this big stone idol. This did not stop her giggles, but infused them with a nearly frantic quality. They were becoming more and more like silent screams. Her belly hurt. Tears streamed down her face. 3. Henry Victor Belch and Patrick Hochstetter ended up in the dump lighting each other's farts on that hot July afternoon because of Rena Davenport. Henry knew what resulted from consuming large amounts of baked beans. This result was perhaps best expressed in a little ditty he had learned at his father's knee when he was still in short pants. Beans, beans, the musical fruit, the more you eat, the more you toot. The more you toot, the better you feel, then you're ready for another meal. Rena Davenport and his father had been courting for nearly 8 years. She was fat, 40, and usually filthy. Henry supposed that Rena and his father sometimes fucked, although he could not imagine anyone squashing his body down on Rena Davenport's. Rena's beans were her pride. She soaked them Saturday nights and baked them over a slow fire all day Sunday. Henry supposed they were okay. They were something to shovel into your mouth and chew up anyway. But after 8 years, anything lost its charm. Nor was Rena content to make just a few beans. She cooked them in job lots. When she turned up Sunday evenings in her old green DeSoto, a naked rubber baby doll hung from the rearview mirror, looking like the world's youngest lynch mob victim, she usually had the Bowers' beans steaming on the seat beside her in a 12-gallon galvanized steel pail. The three of them would eat the beans that night, Rena raving about her own cooking all the while, crazy Butch Bowers grunting and mopping up bean juice with a piece of Sonny Boy bread, or simply telling her to shut up if there was a ball game on the radio. Henry just eating, staring out the window, thinking his own thoughts. It was over a plate of Sunday night beans that he had conceived the idea of poisoning Mike Hanlon's dog, Mr. Chips. And Butch would reheat a mess of them the next night. On Tuesdays and Wednesdays, Henry would take a Tupperware box full of them to school. By Thursday or Friday, neither Henry nor his father could eat any more. The house's two bedrooms would smell of stale farts in spite of the open windows. Butch would take the remains and mix them into the other slops and feed them to Bip and Bop, the Bowers' two pigs. Rena would like as not show up the following Sunday with another steaming pail, and the cycle would start all over again. That morning, Henry had put up an enormous quantity of leftover beans, and the four of them had eaten the whole lot at noon, sitting out on the playground in the shade of a big old elm. They had eaten until they were nearly bursting. It had been Patrick who suggested they go down to the dump, which would be fairly quiet in the middle of a working day summer afternoon. By the time they arrived, the beans were doing their work quite nicely. End of side 21. To continue, turn the cassette over.